Marketplace is supported by Citrix GoToMeeting, personalized meeting rooms to help put your best face forward. More at GoToMeeting.com.
Here's what we've got. We've got the story of Elon Musk as told by his authorized biographer. And we've got Pitch Perfect 2, the woman who wrote it. We're back. That's too easy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Full Sail University, offering accelerated master's degrees that start every month at fullsail.edu/masters. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, new competency-based certifications designed to make the new workplace work. More at shrmcertification.org. And by Constant Contact, a proud Marketplace sponsor for 7 years, committed to helping small businesses succeed with email marketing. Learn more at constantcontact.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 14th of May, and I want you to think for just a second here as we get going today about how much time you spend looking at labels. An informed consumer is a smart consumer, after all. And I mention that because the Associated Press reports today that the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, is going to start issuing its own certifications for foods that are GMO-free. Labels matter, right? Remember what the Energy Star sticker did for the appliance industry? But Marketplace's Adam Allington reports the jury is still kind of out on how consumers might respond to GMO-free.
There are currently no government labels that certify food as GMO-free, nothing akin to the Department of Agriculture's certified organic label. But in a letter obtained by the AP, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack describes a plan to roll out a voluntary GMO-free label companies can pay to get, a government certification that could be a marketing advantage. The label was requested by a large food company.
The natural organic industry is exploding with growth, and the regular food industry is just struggling.
Brian Yarbrough is a consumer research analyst with Edward Jones.
If you're just a core center of the aisle, as I mentioned, a Kraft Food or a Kellogg, you can go back and look at the results. The growth is hard to come by.
Yarbrough says it's still too soon to tell if GMO-free will achieve the same market appeal that organic has, but consumer groups pushing for GMO disclosure aren't thrilled.
We think this is an outrageous move.
Catherine Paul is the associate director of the Organic Consumers Association. The group supports laws requiring companies to disclose GMO ingredients. Making it easier for consumers to find GMO-free food is a good thing, she says, but
not if it's going to cause the manufacturers of those products to have to charge consumers more because they had to pay for that certification.
Food companies oppose mandatory disclosure of GMOs, citing scientific consensus that GMO food is safe. The Department of Agriculture has not said when it will start issuing the labels. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
A moment now to mark the passing of classical music. Yeah, no, not the actual passing of it. It's classical, right? It's always going to be around. But boy, is it not selling well. Classical, according to the good people at Nielsen, makes up just 1.4% of all music consumption out there. Compare that to just, for instance, 29% for rock. Symphony orchestras are dealing with mountains of debt. Audiences really haven't changed much over the years. And that makes classical a tough place to make a living. Marketplace's Gigi Duban has that story.
Laura Downs is a classical pianist, and when she describes what she does, she uses terms familiar to today's generation of starving artists, terms like entrepreneurial and DIY.
We're in survival mode. You know, we need to build an audience, and we're kind of tired of making music for the same people all the time.
So Downs not only does the concert circuit, but she's on social media, she's at schools, and she posts her work on sites like SoundCloud, like this Tchaikovsky piece she plays. She's hoping her music will land on fresh ears. At performances, she looks out into audiences and sees mostly older people who are there because they love Beethoven. Her job?
Is to find the person who could come to the concert hall because you get them curious about Beethoven.
The notion of a not entirely diverse older audience is a challenge for the industry in general.
Michael Bariskin is executive director of Copeland House, which promotes classical music through live performances and outreach programs. He says touring is still the bedrock of an artist's career, but they can't just walk out onto a stage, perform, and go on to the next city.
because there is so much competition for people's attention.
Buriskin says that personal interaction is what makes the difference. And there's a chance to sell a few CDs. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
I don't know if we've got a classical version of the happy music, but if we do, might I humbly suggest to the people who get to decide these kinds of things that today would be a good day to use it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, there was good news today from the world of presidential politics. John Bolton, who tends toward the more conservative side of things, I think it's fair to say, announced he is not going to run for president. Why is that good news, you ask? Because that means there will be one less political campaign book out there for us to deal with. They are something of a rite of passage for would-be presidents, these books, and they come in many flavors, as you know, the memoir, the glorified policy paper, so on and so forth. But who exactly reads them? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer takes it from there.
Walk into about any bookstore in Washington, and they are hard to miss. All the books by presidential hopefuls. James Webb has a book, I Heard My Country Calling. Ben Carson, he wrote a book called One Nation. Then, of course, there's God, Guns, Grits, and Gravy from Mike Huckabee.
Okay, I'm just
going to
put you on hold for a second.
This is where we put the newest books, at least in paperback. So you can see right at the front is Hillary Clinton's paperback just came out last week.
Mark LaFromboys is the book buyer for the Politics and Prose bookstore. He points out other books by Senator Marco Rubio, Congressman Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan's around sometimes. He was down in the coffee shop a couple weeks ago.
This is ground zero for political books, a hangout for politicians and political junkies. But LaFromboys says even here, the presidential campaign book usually has a short shelf life.
A month, 3 weeks.
So why write them?
Candidates feel a lot of pressure to get their message out there in their words with their ideas without the filters of lots and lots of other people.
That's Lissa Muscatine, a former chief speechwriter for Hillary Clinton, who worked on most of Clinton's books. Now she owns Politics and Prose with her husband, Bradley Graham. Muscatine says the candidates' books take many forms, memoirs or manifestos, laying out what they would do as president. Who buys these books? People like Gordon Mantler.
I'm an historian at George Washington University.
Mantler is browsing in the political section. He bought one of President Obama's books, Dreams from My Father.
And I didn't feel like this was the typical memoir that's setting up a presidential or national campaign.
And that's key, according to longtime publisher Peter Osnos, founder and editor of the Public Affairs Publishing Company. He says political writers should open up about their lives and say something original.
I think the most important thing is to write a book that the reader will find authentic.
And it doesn't hurt if people are really interested in you. Dreams from My Father was published in 1995, but sales didn't take off until after Barack Obama's speech at the 2004 Democratic National Convention. And candidates shouldn't worry if their book is a total bomb. We've had some pretty bad writers in the White House. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
There's a new book out there that's getting some buzz this week. It's a non-political book, to be clear. It's about arguably one of the most important entrepreneurs of our time. He runs a couple of high-tech companies, but they are companies that do more than write computer code. They actually make things. Space rockets and electric cars, to be just a bit more precise here. Elon Musk is the CEO of both SpaceX and Tesla, and he is the subject of a new biography by Bloomberg Business reporter Ashley Vance. Ashley, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
There's a biographical sketch to be had here, which starts with a desperately unhappy childhood that forms a lot of what Elon Musk is today, you think?
Yeah. He was born in South Africa, and he was, as you might kind of expect, he was really into sci-fi and video games, and he was a bit of a loner at school. He was very bright. Growing up with his father, his father was pretty hard on him. It's one of these things in the book where Elon and his brother and other family members talk about it, but they never say exactly sort of what it was that was so so difficult about his dad, but you know that it's left this big impression on Elon's life.
And as a result of this, he leaves, and a bunch of other things, we should say. He leaves South Africa when he's a kid. He's like 17, 18 years old, goes to Canada, and winds up, long story short, in Silicon Valley.
Yeah. He backpacks through Canada for about a year, gets to Silicon Valley right as the dot-com boom is taking off, and decides he has to come up with an idea. And he and his brothers kind of more or less like brainstorm on a road trip and come up with the idea for their first company, which was sort of a Yelp meets Google Maps before that existed.
Yeah, it's called Zip2, right?
Yeah, that's right. And they end up selling that company pretty quickly for, you know, Elon comes out in the end with about $22 million, enough money to start his next venture, which would eventually turn into PayPal. But so he's kind of like funding that on his own from the get-go.
That, you know, his roots in Silicon Valley are kind of one of the interesting things about this book, one of the many interesting things about this book, because I think for a lot of people, Elon Musk sprang fully formed into existence with Tesla and SpaceX, maybe a little PayPal if you know the history. But the truth is, he's sort of a conventional Silicon Valley bootstrappy kind of guy.
Yeah, he had to learn a lot during that period. That was one of the things doing the book that I hadn't realized at all beforehand. You know, he at Zip2, he was the CEO of the company, and he was not a great CEO. I mean, he worked really hard, and people were impressed with that. I mean, he outworked everybody, and he had this hustle, and it was smart, but he wasn't great at managing people. He was bad at managing people.
Yeah.
And then he gets to PayPal, and it sort of repeats, although he's getting a little bit better as time goes on, and he's finding ways to kind of marshal people and learn to encourage them, and he realizes you get more out of people if you do that. And so you see him evolve. I mean, this is the first time I think it's really been written about in a ton of detail, is this like evolution of his character.
Which I grant you, but this is the point in the interview where I have to say, okay, hold on a second, because really reading this, he comes off as a big fat word that I am not allowed to say on the radio.
I mean, there's no question. He's a hard dude, and he's still a hard guy today. Yeah. He's the most intense person I've ever met. I definitely don't think there's nobody at Tesla or SpaceX who would say, oh, yeah, he's a real treat to work for today. I mean, he's still pushing them really hard. I think he rubbed people so much the wrong way that, like, in the early days, very early days of PayPal, he had this company called X.com, which turned into PayPal. But, you know, people were defecting and things like that. I mean, it was pretty bad.
There's lots in here about SpaceX and about Tesla, which is totally worth the read. The part of it, though, that is most interesting to me is that point where he has to choose between SpaceX surviving or Tesla surviving, and doesn't. He says, I'm going to make both of them work. The hell with it.
Yeah, it's crazy. So in 2008, I mean, his life is crumbling. Tesla's going bankrupt. SpaceX is doing okay. The rockets are going off. They just have tons of cost, and they're having trouble paying their employees, too, and they're probably going to not make payroll. It gets to December of 2008, and it doesn't look like they'll get to January, and he could basically raise some money for SpaceX and see it through, but he doesn't want Tesla to die, and he does all these crazy financial maneuvers. It's kind of difficult to unpack, but basically he bluffs a few people and raises the money, and then NASA comes through with a big contract that was kind of unexpected, and by Christmas Eve, the day is saved.
It's not quite an epilogue, but it's a summing up, I guess, toward the end of this book. And you say, you know, if he succeeds, he'll be, you know, 55 years old. He'll be the richest man on the planet. His three companies, SolarCity and Tesla and SpaceX, will literally have changed mankind. How real do you think that is?
You know, there's things like with Tesla, when they came out the car and they said, we're going to do this charging network across the United States. And I think I was one of many people who thought that was crazy and it would never happen. And today, there's hundreds of these charging stations, not only in the United States, but in Europe and Asia. And so you've got a guy who's made an electric car and then built the fuel infrastructure to pull it off. When he starts doing things like that, you start giving him the benefit of the doubt. I think SpaceX has changed the space industry. All of its competitors are reacting to it. And, I mean, there's still huge gambles and risks in front of him. But, I mean, the companies are very healthy right now.
It's a book by Ashley Vance called Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Ashley, thanks a lot. It's a good read.
Thank you so much.
Coming up,
And I started writing because I wasn't getting things as an actor. I wasn't like pretty enough to be the ingenue. I wasn't character enough to be the goofball sidekick.
She is pretty funny, though. Pitch Perfect 2, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Maybe that is a classical version. I don't know. Somebody out there tell me. The Dow Industrial's up 191 points today, 1%. Finished at 18,252. The NASDAQ up 69 points, 1.4%. Ended things at 5,050. The S&P 500 gained 22 points, about 1%. Ended things at 2,121. Today clearly is a day for symmetry. That, by the way, is an all-time high for the S&P. Perry Ellis International hiked up 8.5%. Today, the clothier enjoyed better-than-expected first-quarter earnings. Kohl's crept down 13.25% after the retailer reported disappointing first-quarter sales growth. JCPenney dropped 7.7% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.23%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Nuance, advising that an unsecure printer is a printer that exposes companies to a real risk, like unattended documents or scans emailed to the wrong address. Nuance.com/gaincontrol. Gain control over your business documents. And is supported by the University of Southern California. And by Malwarebytes, used by over 80 million folks worldwide to protect against ransomware, identity theft, and other advanced online threats. Built by an international community of engineers, hackers, and researchers. Learn more at malwarebytes.org. When you're not near a radio, listen to Marketplace on your cell phone or tablet. You can hear us on Slacker, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Flipboard, and more, or download our iPhone app. Find the option that's best for you at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Federal Reserve releases its April Industrial Production Report. The University of Michigan issues its preliminary consumer sentiment survey for May. And tomorrow is National Bike to Work Day. What will you do with all that gas money you save? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As if small business owners don't have enough to deal with, and they do have plenty. Even the most mom and popish company out there today has to learn the ins and outs of Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and Tumblr. And you get the idea. Social media. It can be a steep learning curve for proprietors who are often digital non-natives, as Kenny Malone reports now from WLRN in Miami.
Quick small business origin story here.
My real passion was always baking.
Brenda Shapiro bakes a pretty killer mandel bread, which is a traditional Jewish baked good.
A biscotti-type cookie.
Which Brenda learned from her husband's grandmother.
Grandma Libby.
At 50 years old, Brenda quit being a plastic surgery assistant and started a small baking business.
And I actually woke up in the middle of the night and thought of the name Libbylicious, so I wrote it down on a piece of paper.
And unfortunately, you didn't wake up with a social media strategy.
That I didn't wake up with.
At this ladies' night fundraiser for a local kosher food bank, there are wine bottles, massage tables, and then...
Would you like to try my cookies?
Brenda's got the old-school social marketing down, but her social media marketing strategy is essentially take pictures...
It's a great one.
...send them to her daughter-in-law, and she'll post them to the company Twitter account.
It's libbylicious.co.
Which I point out to Brenda might not be accurate because you can't have a period in your Twitter name.
This is why I have my daughter-in-law do this for me. I am busy baking, delivering, packaging, going out and selling my cookies myself, so.
So, Brenda's like a gazillion other small businesses. Last year, the social networking site LinkedIn published survey results that found most small businesses are most concerned with attracting new customers and that they're banking on social media as part of the solution. One pretty clever approach.
I'm in Georgetown, Washington, D.C.,
comes from Georgetown Cupcake. We sent Marlena Chertok, a former Marketplace intern, to show us how this worked. Every day, Georgetown Cupcake posts an off-the-menu flavor on Twitter and Facebook.
Please be something chocolate.
That cupcake's free to the first 100 customers, but you have to ask for it by name.
I'll have the secret flavor, the chocolate dipped toffee, please.
Obviously, this is a great way to get people in the door.
It is so chocolatey. It is just what I wanted.
Yeah, I know. Real tough assignment for Marlena, right? Yeah.
Started back in 2009.
Catherine Berman and Sophie LaMontagne own Georgetown Cupcake. LaMontagne says they use social media to pull back the curtain on their business.
And then secret flavor is one of those ways. It's giving them an inside look at flavors we're developing, things that are not quite on the menu yet, and they feel like they're part of the experience.
And then once people feel like they're part of the experience, once they know about you...
Remember back to the days when there were Blockbuster video stores.
Angela Hausman runs the social media marketing firm Hausman & Associates. She says the voice of one stranger on social media holds irrational power. Like how back in the Blockbuster days, you'd be holding a tape and a random customer would walk up
and say, "Oh yeah, I really liked that movie," or, "No, that was a really stupid movie, don't get that." We believe them.
So what does this all mean for the one-woman mandelbread baking show that is Brenda Shapiro?
Good morning, Nicholas. How are you?
Excellent, thanks.
I put Brenda on the phone with Nicholas Meir. He writes the Social Media Professor blog and teaches at Chapman University, and he broke it down like this.
It could help to have sort of a backstory.
Tell people about Grandma Libby. And remember, the small business owner is an expert in something. Figure out what that is, post something that's informative.
That is not just looking like an ad.
And finally,
the same principles that Dale Carnegie wrote about in How to Win Friends and Influence People still apply in the digital era.
Now, if we can just get Brenda to remember that Twitter handle. It's Libbylicious Co., no dot.
Okay, now I've just learned something new tonight.
In Miami, I'm Kenny, at Radio Malone, for Marketplace.
There's a movie coming out tomorrow for which expectations are on the higher side. That's mostly because it's a sequel to Pitch Perfect, the sleeper hit from a couple of years ago about an all-girl a cappella group called the Bellas.
The Bellas are suspended.
If we win the world championships, will you reinstate us?
If you win it.
Oh! Kate Cannon wrote both the original and the sequel, Pitch Perfect 2, it's called, after spending a good part of her career writing for television on shows like 30 Rock and New Girl. Kate, thanks a lot for coming into the studio.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder whether you're moderately terrified, because you set a pretty high bar here with the original film.
I was absolutely terrified when I first got the call that there was going to be a sequel.
Really?
I thought I was going to barf. I had a very, very frightening reaction to when they called and said that there would be a second one because I was so afraid that I would
fail
miserably.
Did they tell you or ask you?
They told me.
Oh, because
that's
was,
how they do that.
Oh,
they
really?
Don't they don't care what I think.
was it easier to write this one knowing the characters as you do, I imagine, from having written the first one?
In a practical sense, yes, it was absolutely easier to write the second one than the first one. On a personal level, I lost my father and had a baby.
Oh, man.
So I had to write the second one very, very fast. And so, not to get too much information here, but I was like breastfeeding over a computer and like...
Yeah, well, you know, moms do that all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
that's the reality.
I was glad that in having that crazy up and down of life that I was in that world, that it's a very fun, very joyful world and those characters I love. And so it was nice to be doing that.
Let me back you up for a minute and get the, not origin story, but where you came from. You started in improv. You got a degree in theater, right?
And I have a master's
in
education.
And a master's in education? What are you doing?
Which I have never used. Education happens outside the classroom every day.
So how did it come to pass? I mean, you're doing improv and then you wind up on 30 Rock. I mean, it's a pretty interesting story.
I was improvising a ton. I was performing a ton. I was doing the Second City out of Chicago and then in Vegas for a couple of years.
Wow.
And I basically became, you know, friends with Tina Fey. And it was weird. When you have a friend like Tina Fey, who's doing what she's doing.
Name dropper. Cut it out when you have
sure.
a friend. Humble brag. Come on.
Braggy brag. Straight up brag. right in front of your face. But you don't... I would have never thought to give her my material to read because it's Tina Fey. And if it's not good, you don't want, you know, someone like her to read it, not like it, and then your dreams all be crushed. But I started writing because I wasn't getting... things as an actor. I wasn't like pretty enough to be the ingenue. I wasn't character enough to be the goofball sidekick. I'm kind of ethnically ambiguous. I just wasn't like walking into a room and fitting any one part. So I was like, I got to write for myself. I have to literally write my own ticket. And so I wrote this pilot called Big Foam Finger. I'm a big football fan, and it's kind of like sort of a football show, a comedy. Tina read that. She liked it. And then when she was staffing for 30 Rock, she asked me, like, would I be interested in, you know, in writing?
and you said, yeah.
Of course, yes. And she's like, well, you know, we're friends. If I have to fire you, because I'd never written on a show before, she's like, are we going to be okay? And I was like, I look forward to the day you fire me. Like,
wow.
Yes, please.
That's how I got into writing. That's a tough story.
Yeah.
Back to the movie for a second. Talk to me about this moment. What's it like for you to have this thing? I mean, you know, on my drive to work, there's a big billboard or like seven that say,
yeah,
the pitch is back or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's
back pitches. That's what it is.
We're back pitches. And I'm always wanting to like put a comma after back, which is kind of bumming me out. That's what I
see. Just, that's the writer.
That's what I see.
Come on.
I really, you know, not to sound cliche, but I feel like it's a bit surreal because I was just happy the first one got made. And then to see the reactions of everybody, it does feel like there's an anticipation for this movie. It's very exciting.
Do you like being in the business in this town? You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And I think if I was struggling, like I'll give you an example. Yesterday I had an audition, just a regular audition. I was just called in. And for something for Amazon. You know, I do the whole thing where I go to Dry Bar to get my hair blown out. I get, you know, I'm wearing the right outfit that they want me to wear. It takes me 45 minutes to get to the audition. I go there and they don't know me. I'm not made to feel special. I go in, I do the audition, I leave. And I was just reminded how awful of an experience that is. Auditioning is just the worst. So if that was my struggle still all these years later and that's what I was doing, the answer wouldn't be yes to you.
The answer wouldn't be, I like it.
Yeah.
Kate Cannon, the movie is pitch perfect too. Kate, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This final note on the way out today, it's about beer and water and a Miller Coors brewery here in Los Angeles that has joined a drought awareness campaign. The company says it's proud that it's been able to reduce the amount of water it uses in brewing by more than a billion gallons, which is, in all seriousness, great. The drought is a big deal out here. That's fabulous. But seriously, what we're getting now is the less watery version of Miller Coors? I don't... What? How?
Marketplace is supported by MailChimp. More than 7 million people and businesses around the world use MailChimp to design and send email newsletters. More at MailChimp.com. And by Kronos, with cloud-based workforce management solutions designed for organizations to maximize their most valued asset, their workforce. Kronos.com. Kronos, workforce innovation that works. And by Dollar Shave Club Monthly Service, with customizable delivery of three different razors and products to the doorsteps of their million-plus members, dollarshaveclub.com.
All right, we're out of here. The Dow up 191 points today. That is 1%. The Nasdaq put on 69 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 gained 22 points, about 1%. Gold to Arthur, Kate Concannon, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.